Hello again, and welcome back to the next episode of the Balticon 47 wrap-up, brought to you by Swimming Cat Studios. I'm Doc Coleman, your host. Today I am pleased to bring you the first of two readings that I was fortunate enough to participate in at this year's Balticon. For this reading, I shared the mic with PJ Schneider and Grig Punky Larson. This reading had been billed as a steampunk reading, and while each of us has written steampunk at some time in the past, the reading itself ended up being a mixture of different genres. This audio was recorded on Saturday night, May 25th, at 11 p.m., just after the Dirty Mad Libs Part 1 panel, and at the same time that Starla Hutchton and Patrick Scafido were recording Dirty Mad Libs Part 2. We had a little bit of a delay in getting set up because the room we were scheduled to use had been taken over by the masquerade judging, and we had to commandeer a nearby room for our recording. PJ Schneider starts us off, and while she doesn't read a steampunk selection, she does give us a rather steamy section from her new paranormal romance novella, Bite Me, the first book in her London Undead series. That book was released in June, so while this was a sneak preview for us at Balticon, you can get your hands on a copy of the ebook now. Just look for links in the show notes of this episode. Next up is Grig Larson, who favors us with a reading from his forthcoming novel, tentatively titled Space Bitch. This piece is a bit of sci-fi comedy, which takes a little while to get established, but has a hilarious payoff at the end. Space Bitch is due to be released sometime in fall of 2013. Finally, it is my turn. I gave the audience a choice. I could read a section from my Parsec-nominated Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences short story, The Cross of Columba, or I could read a new section from my forthcoming novel, The Perils of Prague. The vote was overwhelmingly for Prague. If you'd like to hear more from The Perils of Prague, please check out my reading from Balticon 46. Perils is in edits right now, and I hope to have it ready for release in ebook form and as a full cast podcast in the fall of 2013. So that's enough of me for now. I hope that you'll enjoy all three of these readings, and that you'll be back next week for more from the Balticon 47 wrap-up. Enjoy!
Yeah, we're living in the future, all right.
That's
and
right.
I'm in the past of the future. I still have a laptop.
How long is our selection supposed to be? Like one page, two page?
Well, there's three of us, so whatever's going to take you about 15 minutes to read.
That's pretty average for a guy.
Oh!
I'm a bad person, I'm sorry.
No, just tell bad jokes. Well, I guess this
is... Do you want me to start this, or are you going to...
I can start it. I don't think there's a moderator listed.
No, it's just a reading.
We all
can
fight
I go
to
first?
The death. Yes.
Yay!
Let's start off by... Thank you all for coming out to our reading tonight.
It's pugilistic.
Wait, where am I starting? I'm going first, but...
Ladies first.
All right.
Yeah. Unlike Dirty Mad Libs, the ladies get to come first.
Oh, you're recording me.
Yes, I'm recording.
Well... You know what? Make taking sure care of your partner is kind of a considerate act.
Peter, Paul, and Mary.
So, I think what I'll do is I'm going to read a portion of what I read yesterday, last night, but I'll finish it for you. Because I left them off at a teaser yesterday.
For you, she goes all the way.
Yes, for you guys. For you all. Okay. A little bit of background. We has a werewolf. In London, fighting zombies, meets a human girl. She shoots him the first time they meet. He obviously survives.
Must be love.
It was. There was they grew on each other.
Is Bite Me?
What?
Like fungus?
This is Bite Me. So Bite Me is coming out June 24th. This is sort of a sneak peek read. Warning, is saucy. All right, we're moving on. Ready? It's fuzzy. The microphone's fuzzy.
Yeah, I have cats. Of course the microphone. It's working.
Oh, BKBs. Okay, we're starting with the guys.
Tongues?
Yes. Seth loved the way her cheeks and other interesting bits blushed deep red when he got her riled up. Oh, any plan to make up for it, no doubt there. He waited only another couple of moments to enjoy how beautiful and alive she was lying in his bed. Dipping his head, he dropped a light kiss on her big toe, then another on the graceful arch of her foot, making his way up her ankle and calf to her knee, taking his time about repeating the gestures with her other scarred leg. "I," she gasped, and he looked up to see her fingers fiddling with the edge of the pillows. "It's been a long time since I've properly felt anything there." He smiled and caressed her perfect left foot, the one she probably expected to be as damaged as her old injury. She's handicapped. "The zombie infection took over most of this leg," Danny said. "When the lycanthropy virus, the factor that turns us to werewolves, took over faster, it healed your leg from the inside out." He said something about genetic maps, stem cells, and things. "Either way, the only scars we have as werewolves are the original bites that made us, usually." He kissed her foot again, then ran his claws lightly along the underside. She twitched, ticklish, and he laughed. She cursed at him, and he laughed harder. But he didn't lose focus, oh no. His Maisie still had her panties on, and he intended to remedy that in short order. He ran his hands over her legs in soothing circles, enjoying the way her skin heated under his touch, placing a kiss here and there, on her knee, on the inside of one thigh, in the crease of her hip. By the time he hovered over her panties, he was half drunk on her scent. When he blew gently over the thin cloth, a hint of wetness spread across the fabric. Almost ready for him, and he planned to be sure she wanted him every bit as much as he wanted her. Lifting the side of her panties, he started to slice the fabric with a single claw, careful not to damage her creamy skin. "What am I going to do for clothes?" The words came out a little breathless. He tossed away her panties, admiring her naked body under his. "Oh, you won't need them for the time being." Covering her with his own body, he pressed his hips snug to hers, the length of his erection hard between them. She placed her hands on his shoulders, the hesitation in her touch reminding him he'd want to go slow, give her time to get used to him. So he took his time. He kissed her breathless and nibbled at her neck until she giggled. He ran his hands over her body, along her sides. Her breasts were a perfect fit for the palms of his hands, and he enjoyed kneading them, teasing her nipples between thumb and forefinger, and then suckling them until she moaned. Once she writhed under him, gasping and pulling him against her, he slid his knee between her legs. She pressed kisses over his shoulder and drifted them across his collarbone, whispering against his skin. "Please." He wouldn't deny her anything in his power to give. "Please, Seth. I've got to have you now." And now, he wasn't as likely to hurt her, not when she was a werewolf, too. Bracing himself on one arm, he used his other hand to guide himself between her legs. As he pressed the tip of his cock to her entrance, he found her hot and slick and ready. Gritting his teeth for control, he nudged inside her just the tip, teasing her tight entrance until she angled her hips upward. He gave in then, sliding into her, stretching her as her inner muscles clenched around him. She called out as he entered her. Gathering her against him, he kissed her temple. Turning her head, she found his lips and kissed him hungrily, even as her hands settled on his waist, tugging and encouraging him. He'd planned to be gentle, slow. But she wrapped her legs around his hips. His Maisie wanted more. He gave it to her. He ground his hips into her until he was buried to the hilt, then pulled out and slid back inside her again and again. Picking up the rhythm, she lifted her hips to meet him until they both were holding on to each other for the ride of their lives. "Seth!" She bucked against him as her inner muscles spasmed and his balls tightened. As she screamed his name, he followed her over the edge into orgasm.
Here's a feeling off of the first reading.
I need you to file my taxes, ma'am.
Somewhere around, what am I going to do for clothes?
I know there's a blockage in your safe. Dun dun.
Dun dun.
Now I feel like I should follow that up by reading my Dirty Mad Lib again.
Well,
shall I go next, or do you want to?
I can go next. I have a. This was supposed to be steampunk, or was it? Is it free for all?
The program said steampunk.
I didn't see the program. The pocket program didn't say anything.
That's what Doc was saying.
So. No, actually, that was what I got was out of the pocket program.
I'll show it
to you later.
Okay.
I prepared a couple steampunk things, but if you want to read something else, go for it. I have
either or. Does anybody want to hear steampunk, or do they want to hear violent science fiction?
All right. All for steampunk? All for violent science fiction.
All right.
That's pretty even.
Read what you want.
This is a selection from my next book, which is going to be hopefully coming out after the summer, called Space Bitch. It is a story about an incredibly psychotic space captain and her crew. And most of it is told from the point of view of a political refugee who has decided to become a starship captain in a colonial space. So in this point, she has been training for a while, and she's now showing up for her first assignment, only to be told that she is going to have a captain who she knows is psychotic, who had beaten her up in a hotel, and she knows, oh, my God. So she's trying to be as good as she can when not being nervous. A graduated Sarah now nervously looked at the delivery ship that would be her first assignment. It was painted a new coat of cheerful blue with a bright yellow accents. It was also eerily coffin-shaped. Her training ship had been stubby in comparison to the Liberty-class interstellar cargo ship that stretched in the hangar bay. Over 16 isolated cargo bays and a thin hexagonal bar propped off the ground by 6 landing shocks. It took a normal person nearly a full minute to go from one end to the other at a brisk pace. At the front, there was a squat half-disc and several slanted windows that were aft, and on the after, 4 flexible impulse thrusters on stubby wings. Several labels on the underside indicated that this was a standard self-digging interstellar-going vessel with a stock interstellar drive capable of taking a lot of bumps and bruises. Sarah wondered if Eliza was already aboard. Next to her, 3 fellow graduates, as hand-selected by Sarah, in a whisper into Yolanda's ear at graduation ceremony. She didn't like any of them, which is the main point why she selected them. Class had been fairly complicated. Sarah had kept to herself as much as she could, avoiding the jokes at her expense and burying her face into the material from the moment she awoke to the moment she fell asleep. Sarah had been never seen without a handheld exam preparation pad in her glowing hand. She studied at the mess hall during breaks and while waiting for line in the flight simulators. Buried in flashcards, textbooks, and laminated workbooks, Sarah shielded herself from her own self-doubt. As the weeks progressed, her perfect marks and considerable performance during oral exams, customer service training, and ship simulations were making her the target of much angst and jealousy by other students. She wasn't sure if it was because she was the only woman or they just didn't like a smartass. Her teachers were inexplicably harsh on her. It was only Yolanda, which was her captain, occasional presence that prevented her from cutting her too deep. Hated by teachers and students alike, Sarah didn't like being dependent on Yolanda, who went as far as to review her exams in front of her teachers and criticizing their grading techniques if they were a hair's distance from procedure. Of course, if Sarah got something wrong, she was just as harshly criticized by Yolanda, but no one else seemed to notice this. Sarah counted the days until graduation, praying they would pass her to get rid of her. There was only one place that Sarah did not study. When things got too stressful, she would dress up in loose clothing, hiding her silhouetted face, head down to the local arcade at a time that the crowds were low. In the early morning hours, Sarah would wander down the aisles of games, hearing them echo across the concrete walls and floor in the empty and cavernous space as she looked for a free fighter pilot simulator. She'd play these simulators when she had vacation days from her previous job, but this time she depended on them for her sanity. Her feverish mind, with the pressure and rage of the Sun God, which is the company, corporate knowledge and delivery procedures, needed to release the precision flying and the love that she still shared from her childhood. Through forms, customs to tariffs, which the creases went into her uniform pleats, they all melted away when Sarah's body sighed into the molded seat of the simulator, cutting off her only harsh glare of the outside life. Sarah was married when she was only 4. She had a few scant memories that day. There were a lot of bright colors, and she was dressed in gold and orange silks. The wedding was held in her father's largest temple next to a spaceport in Mogadishu. She was placed on pillows when she met her new husband, a tall man with a funny accent. Until this day, Sarah had never met her husband of the arranged marriage, Daniel Thistlethwaite. The Thistlethwaites were an old money on Earth, and the man who married Sarah was from an area known as Europa Britannia, a large cluster of islands and floating platform cities in the North Atlantic Sea. But she was more interested in the ships leaving and arriving in the sky, and the six-hour royal dedication and marriage ceremony droned on and on. She fell asleep a few times, lazily following the contrails as they curved into the atmosphere. Her father would become a very powerful and corporate might in a vast region, selling warships, cargo ships, and passenger liners with almost exclusively to the new rulers of the hefty slice of the galaxy. His dealings with the VRG were rumored to be part of a vast murder of key family groups in the ruling class, the GMD, the Galactic Mercantile Dominion, a loose collection of merchant families that had ruled for nearly 1,000 years. Sadly, when Sarah was 8, she was informed that her husband had died in a hunting accident. As per her father's custom, she was treated as a widow, shaved, bald, and considered dead, along with her husband. She was scorned by dozens of siblings and half-siblings. It was only by the grace of her own father that she was allowed to live at all. Most women in her position were left to starve to death. "Make yourself useful, Sarah," her father said. "There is always a garden to work to be done. Wear many layers of burial cloth so to hide your face and form. You may live as a ghost tending to the thousands of glaciers." Her father took, I'm going to skip a little bit here, because it talks a lot about her earlier past. And she went to a Starship Academy as a boy, and then by the time it was very obvious that she was a girl, her father's like, "You've been reborn, and I can remarry you now." And so she fled. As the name Even Chapana, it was what she was known as a student. The name of Even Chapana never died, however. When Sarah ran her hands over the tops of the fighter ship simulators, only she knew why this name was the leader of the scoreboards that flashed atop every arcade. None of her classmates nor the locals knew that the player who had all the top battle scores was a female captain of the local sun god trading facility. Sarah tried to dilute her legendary status by attempting to convince people it's simply a fake account the simulator company used to keep people paying for another round. Now, that didn't work as well as she would have hoped, and after a few months, Avion's name was on everybody's lips. Those who depended on arcades as the only validation in their lives hunted for this mythical Avion. Dock workers, cargo haulers, soldiers, society's toughest and meanest miscreants scanned the arcade floors trying to find her. But the fear of her being discovered only added to the adrenaline rush. Avion came close to being discovered a few times. From time to time, a few people claimed to be Avion, much to Sarah's relief, but they didn't last long as these decoy Avions found their troubles for their ruse, led them to being beaten and left dead in a random alley. Months went by, classes and training regiments blurred together. Sarah barely ate and lost so much weight they had to resize her uniform twice. "You have plenty of time to starve out in the colonies," Yolanda told her one day. "You need to eat now. You need to toughen up, or Eliza will break you like a dead twig, and you will be of no further use to me." But nervousness of serving with Eliza did nothing to increase her appetite. She followed Eliza's trial and reports, noting passages with vague details and concerning. Prosecution. Verbal presence. Issue number 104. Eliza Mortalis was operating an illegal Mosadrine refining lab inside cargo bay 6 of her ship and several international drug violations, including possession, manufacturing, refining, and distribution for profit, is listed in document 401A through F. Eliza, verbal and somatic response. "I fucked your mom!" 6 months later, time had run out. Sarah stood at the podium, receiving her official license signaling as she graduated and became an official pilot. Her face flashed on the screen, showing everyone her official captain's ID card. She wasn't even surprised when her classmates booed, and her thoughts were occupied elsewhere. While her classmates were getting drunk in the plethora of after-graduation ceremonies, Avion took her last flight to the most populated time of the evening, a risk that she dared not take. But she wasn't going to be on the moon of Hotsis after she got her chip implant. She felt she owed the final arcade a final up yours. As she lowered herself into the pod, she slid her shoes off and placed her bare feet on the metal pedals, and her heart raced. When the pod closed and the hiss of the vacuum popped her ears, she took off her hat and veil. Normally she flew alone, but this one time she assigned herself a team. Goosebumps raised as her adrenaline soared. Her tanned skin became a shiny bronze as her pupils dilated to make her brown iris almost completely black. Sarah was still a virgin, and this was the closest to sex she had ever come to. Her body molded into the chair as she tapped the commands. She was distantly aware a crowd was gathering around her pod because her name must have popped up on the leaderboards for a group assault. They couldn't see her through the thickly darkened glass, but they marveled at what they could in the glimpse of the fabled Avion. Minutes later, her team was reduced to half. She had selected the highest scoring players available and played the toughest rounds. Players who saw the name Avion select them nearly wet themselves with excitement when they agreed, but soon they realized there were nothing but debris left in Avion's wake as she single-handedly took on every fighter herself. Angered and disillusioned, they sought out her pod when the game informed that they had been killed by their own captain. And when the last of the team members realized that she only selected them to be decoys and cannon fodder, Avion had scored the highest round that night. And when she was done with all the battle, declared the highest score of all time, a slightly rumpled and widely grinning Sarah emerged from the pod amongst a seething crowd of onlookers. The outcries of duty to one's team, the breaking of the manly code, were cut short, and they realized a feminine form had arisen from the simulator, like Aphrodite emerging from a lake. "I just graduated, boys," she said coyly. "Why not congratulate me?" It was a line she had rehearsed in her mind a dozen times, but halfway through her quote, there was an errant siren that master brilliantly conceived line when a small child had won a large stuffed toy by inflating a balloon in a clown's face with a water gun. "What?" someone asked after a long pause. "Hey, you're a girl," some dimwit finally noticed. The moment was gone. Sarah hopped out of the pod, pushed away through the crowd, and tried to hold on to the moment as long as she could. Had it not been for the ill-timed siren, it would have been a good line, but her own self-doubt eventually swooped down on her, and the next thing she knew, she was back in her dorm room, packing her things through her stinging tears. At some point, she realized she had forgotten her shoes back in that pod, adding to the indignity of the whole situation. In her mail bin was a small sheet of orders to report to medical, where she would spend the next few days getting a job. That was a week in the past, and now she was standing in front of her ship, absently touching the surgical scar behind her ear. It wasn't her ship, yet, but she was assured that Eliza Mortalis would commit some violation and be removed from duty. She had the chip implanted just over her right ear and said been testing it all morning, like one tests a loose tooth with her tongue. She encrypted and decrypted test patterns they gave her, and even as she looked at the duty roster, part of her was trying to scramble the data in a manner that would be transmittable and the most secure of connections. She saw a few familiar faces. There were classmates that were that she had selected, and Yolanda had asked her to point out in potential selection. Sarah selected the classmate she didn't like, knowing she was throwing raw meat to distract a pursuing predator. Sarah was not a cruel person, but she felt these people were best suited for the task ahead, or were likely to pose a short-term threat. There was Riffer, a scrawny and nervous man with a mosadrine addiction. Riffer had never been mean to Sarah, but Sarah knew he was destined to die one way or another. Mosadrine was an illegal substance, a stimulant that once it had you would never let go, like a slow death sentence that battled for your attention span until it weakened your self-respect and eventually you starved to death while watching a repeated pattern on the video screen. As Riffer looked at Sarah with twitching eyes, she could not tell that if he was upset to see her or trying to remember who she was. Sarah was sure that the only reason he was allowed to graduate was so he would be placed on this mission. One person who was not glad to see her was Patrick. Patrick had that kind of was that kind of person people loved to hate, Sarah felt. Arrogant and patronizing, he was also two-faced and politically motivated, like some of her older brothers. He was not dissimilar to a childhood story villain, right down to the wealth and vanity. His suit was the best pressed, most crisp, and cleaned by Bayant servants dressed in tuxedos. Patrick had most likely purchased his exam answers from a friend of the family, so he was upset that an impoverished Sarah often beat him at his scores. He was a little confused why he'd been chosen to work in the outer colony run, but he knew his family would soon get him out of it. Sarah never forgot his involvement. There was a thing where he had tricked her. Last, there was Tyler, who was a best friend of Antodia Patrick. Patrick used this to his advantage and always felt Tyler swimming in his wake. Tyler's psychopathic attitude was the epitome of lack of self-respect, and Sarah was positive if she wasn't unified focus of class hatred, Tyler would have had the honored position of the bottom of the totem pole. Even when the other classmates made kissing noises of praise of Patrick, but Tyler never wavered his undying devotion just to nibble at the choicest scraps of an elite class he would never otherwise be allowed to mingle with. There were also a few Bayonts, mostly bustle and mechanic variety. The new line of MMCP, the mechanical manufacturing general purpose Bayonts, were a little unusual. They're not as tall as other humans due to a ruling discerning Bayonts from humans in mechanical situations. This line had a jet black hair like Sarah's, which clung to their heads like a dark bowl. "Hello, Sarah," Patrick said, his smile soaked with venom. "Have you been assigned to the ship?" "I am Chief Security Officer," he said that last statement with the practiced air of a seasoned snob. Sarah cracked a smile. There was no real title of Chief Security Officer, just Security, which Sarah knew was an office merely him and an officer named Jennifer Koypak that she hadn't met yet. I know, she said with an impish smile. It's my duty to know who's on my ship. Patrick's smile drooped just slightly. I'm sorry, your ship. I was under the impression that no one was given charge of their own ship after classes. He chuckled, which was echoed by Tyler. My sweet, you have to earn. I expect that when you read your assignment sheet, you will not address me as sweet, but as superior. I'm first officer, second in command under Captain Eliza Mortalis. Somehow, that sounded even scarier when she said it aloud and her voice wavered slightly. You're joking, said Tyler, eager to jump in. He stood as tall as he could, which was still shorter than Patrick, and puffed out his chest as if to claim his ground. You're my navigations officer, Tyler, Sarah replied with a superior smirk. Given your marks in stellar cartography and interstellar anomalies, I really hope you still have your textbooks with you. Nothing but a co-pilot, Sarah, Patrick reminded her, but Sarah had already turned away from him, a bionic milling about the loading area. They started to line up once they recognized her as a superior officer. I'm First Officer Sarah Pulunjama of the Cecil Australis V. Sarah addressed her bionts. Have you been briefed to your duties? The bionts had lined up and saluted her, and a few more ran to the line as soon as they witnessed the other bionts saluting. Sarah thought for a delivery company and claimed they were not military through all their training seemed to be in a disproportionate amount of decorum. She saluted back to them out of reflex. Who's chief dock officer among you? One has not been assigned. We are waiting for you, said one named Israel, according to his sleeve. Bionte Israel, has the ship been inspected? No, ma'am. Has the cargo been checked and loaded? No, ma'am. The confident reply seemed out of place with the information it suggested. Why? How long have you been here? We were delivered to this location 3 hours ago. Have you met the captain? I'm told she's around here somewhere. We took advantage of time and started assembling the cargo to the loading pallets. I need to report for duty. You know where she is? Well, look at you, said a piercing voice from behind her. All spiffy and legal. Sarah spun around and saluted before fear could cause her to hesitate. Captain Mortalis, she started, but her throat closed with a squeak. Quickly, she cleared it and continued, I'm your assigned first officer. Oh, thank you very much. Sarah Pulunjama, to your vessel, the Australis V. I am reporting for duty. She did not make eye contact and was unable to force herself to do so. She looked straight ahead at a series of valves and cooling pipes on a far distant wall, convincing herself this was proper procedure. You look familiar, Eliza said, slinking into Sarah's view. Have we met? Sarah wasn't sure what to reply. She could even bring up the hotel restaurant incident. Maybe Eliza was drunk and didn't remember. Maybe Sarah could start a new relationship? Or did Eliza remember her was testing her? I have been training for the last few months, ma'am. It's entirely... Who are you? Eliza asked Patrick as the conversation with Sarah now bored her. You are Captain Mortalis? Patrick asked, as if this was yet another indignity I had to endure in this dreadfully complicated morning. Sarah cringed in anticipation of Eliza's ire and sighed with relief when Eliza moved out of her field of view. But despite her hesitation, she couldn't help but wonder how quickly Eliza might kill Patrick and whether she should just hit the deck now and avoid the blood splatter on her new uniform. The vision of the captain's head exploding never quite left her background thoughts. Yes, I know who I am, Eliza barked. I do not need someone to remind me who I am, and if I did, that would be Miss Pulunjama's job here, or accusing me of being so feeble-minded that I have to be reminded of my... No, Captain, I was just a little shocked. Perhaps you could tell me that you're the deck crew for this loading dock. If your ship is my officer, I think I'll just slit your throat and put you out of my misery. Eliza made a cutting motion with her thumb across Patrick's exposed neck. How dare you speak to me that way, Patrick said, slapping away Eliza's hand. Even the bionts cringed, and the sudden silence was deafening. I bet you can't do that again, Eliza said, holding out her hand. Sarah noticed it was rock steady and stayed motionless like a cobra about to strike. Try me. Sarah couldn't tell if Patrick actually did try and slap Eliza's hand away, but in the blink of an eye there was a snapping noise, and Patrick was screaming, rolling on the concrete floor and clutching his wrist bent at a disturbing and quite unnatural angle. And who are you? Eliza asked Tyler. Eliza didn't even seem concerned by Patrick anymore than someone who would be concerned about trash they had just discarded in a nearby bin. Tyler was already pale, looking at Patrick on his knees, wailing in pain. Tyler, ma'am, how is it that a woman told me your name and rank, and now she was related to me? The ship were flying, even though I interrupted you in the middle of her job. Meanwhile, you two just stood there like some kind of fancy statues. Why? To impress your bastard children? What? Tyler asked. Did I stutter? Eliza growled. No, I'm your navigations officer. I mean, Officer Tyler Claymore, navigations too late, Eliza said, kick swept him to the floor. Tyler allowed himself to fall and stayed on the floor, curled up. And you, Eliza asked Riffer. Look at you, tell me. Eliza paused, wiggling her fingers in some kind of undulating pattern, seeing walking centipedes. Riffer leaned forward to the motion, his lips moist. Look at you. Oh, so many patterns to entertain your corrupted visual cortex with. She turned to Sarah, who suddenly realized she should have been buried in work. You a medic, Sarah? No, ma'am, but I've received basic training as per... I'm not asking officially, girl. I know if you're going to repair a broken wrist and a man prone to the floor soaked in his own cowardice. No need to be scared. You know how to cure a man of a Mosadrine addict? Eliza suddenly snapped as she narrowed to a row of bions. What are these disgusting, tube-farm, genetically sterile ass-wipers doing here? The bions? They are your deck crew. I don't need them. Send them away. But how will you... I said send them away, Sarah. Sarah looked at the bions, who returned confused and frightened looks back. You may go? Go where? Asked one bion. Sarah was unsure as she was already shaking. Eliza pulled out a pistol. Fuck me with a cargo hook. Do I have to do everything myself? She asked as she fired a series of rounds into the bion. Her gunfire was so fast that despite the fact it was not automatic fire, the corpse didn't even fall to the ground before it had been shot four or five times. The remains lay streaked and sizzling on the floor as the other bions ran for cover. Run, my little scared rabbits! Run! She shouted, firing at the scattered crew. Shot one more in the back and another in the leg as she gritted her teeth and screamed through the closed mouth like her head was going to explode. Sarah ran behind a small stack of crates and plugged her ears, trying to block out the noise that echoed around the metal walls, as well as shut out the image of the dying bions. That's enough, Eliza, Yolanda shouted from the hangar door. Despite the serious danger she was in by entering the hangar, Yolanda strode with a confidence that stopped Eliza's firing. You know I fucking hate bions, Yolanda. Sarah lowered her pistol as a few surviving bions ran for the nearest exits. Yolanda strode up to Eliza without any hesitation or signal of fear. They are company equipment. You had no reason to... Where is Sarah? Hiding behind the crates, Elizabeth chuckled. Ha! What a useless cunt. What kind of crew did you think? Drop your weapon. Sarah's best in her class. You would do... Yolanda, I'm not going to have a crew. I worked alone. We discussed this. Eliza tossed her gun aside, where it clattered in front of Sarah's huddled form. Sarah could still feel the heat coming from the muzzle. I'm going to stop here so the other people... Are, yep. That is my book that will be coming out. I also have a current steampunk horror book called Trolley, which is available in the artist alley downstairs tomorrow.
We didn't do introductions. We just jumped into this.
We totally jumped into this.
Yeah. So since you've already talked about where your stuff is, you want to introduce yourself.
Yes. My name is Greg Larson. I am the president of KatsuCon Entertainment, which runs KatsuCon every year. I also have written several books, the Punk Walrus Saga, Trolley, and Space Bitch, which is coming up. I also have written several short stories, which are appeared in anthologies. You can look me up on Amazon.com and or downstairs at the table. And I've been in fandom since, like, the 80s. And this book, Space Bitch, came from a panel where somebody said, how come there are no strong female protagonists? And someone's like, what about Ripley and Alien? And some people are like, oh, yeah, what about Ripley and Alien? And then someone said, you couldn't have a ship of all women. They would all go crazy and kill each other. And it was like, that's the most misogynistic statement I ever heard, Mr. Clement. No, he didn't say that. But for those who knew him. So this had been boiling in my head. Like, what would happen if an all-female ship went crazy and were trying to kill each other all the time? So this is kind of like a dark comedy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. I'm PJ Schneider. hello. I'm an author of paranormal and sci-fi romance, as well as steampunk and urban fantasy. I kicked off with a saucy steam from my... we have laughter. from my upcoming novella from Karina Press called Bite Me, which is set in the zombie apocalypse and releases June 24th. It is paranormal romance, as you can tell.
Okay, and I am Doc Coleman. I am a podcaster, a voice actor, and a writer. And I'm going to give you a choice of what I'm going to read today. Both are steampunk selections, since the program promised you steampunk. I can either read from my Parsec-nominated story, The Cross of Columba, or I can read a new section from my in-work novel, The Perils of Prague. So, okay.
It sounds unanimous.
This is a different selection than what I read from last year. This is actually several chapters later.
Well, like, yay.
Okay.
No.
So, at this point in the story, the narrator has met up with Professor Harmonious Crackle and his assistant, Miss Titania Bang, and they have attended the opera together, at which point the opera house collapsed. They managed to get the other people out of the opera house. They themselves got caught in the rubble. They managed to pull themselves out of the rubble, at which point there was a gas explosion. And then they were pointed out by someone in the crowd to the police and were promptly arrested. They have since been released from police custody after assuring them that they did not have any part in the goings-on. And they have retired to the professor's airship, where they have had a chance to refresh themselves. And as we pick up the action, Miss Bang is leading our narrator to talk with the professor. I had expected Miss Bang to lead me to the bridge of the airship, but when she led me up another flight of stairs and down another long hallway, I was unprepared for her to lead me into a large laboratory. The room looked as if it had been lifted whole from a university. A number of workbenches were scattered about the room, each apparently dedicated to a different scientific study. Along one wall was a table supporting a large and intricate assortment of glass pipettes, flasks, and other doohickeys connected in a vast and confusing array. Burners were arrayed beneath several boiling flasks, and a brown liquid dripped into an equal number of insulated bottles at the opposite end of the table. Another table contained a microscope and a variety of weights and scales and tools for handling samples. At the far end of the room were several large pieces of equipment that bore the thick cables and massive switches that marked electrical experiments. Another bench resembled a machinist bench with a number of belt-driven devices for cutting, boring, and shaping metal. As we entered, we found Professor Crackle, still in his attire of the night before, working at a table littered with cogs and springs and all matter of small tools. Harmonious, Miss Bang called as we entered. The professor did not appear to take any notice of our approach. Indeed, he seemed to be very intently studying something through a jeweler's loop lodged in his right eye. He muttered something to himself as he did so, but I was unable to make out any of his words. Harmonious, Miss Bang repeated as she laid a hand upon his shoulder. We need to speak to you about a matter. I know this hand. I know I do. I just can't remember where I've seen it before, the professor interrupted, turning to Miss Bang with the loop still firmly fixed to his eye. But I know I've seen his work before. It is exquisite. How could I have seen someone who could produce work of this quality? He gestured with what appeared to be the wing of a bird that had gotten trapped underneath my shoe. And not remember who it was. Harmonious, I need to ask you about our guest, she said, gesturing towards me, where I stood near the door, marveling at the perplexing array of equipment in the laboratory. He says that, she started, but now that his attention had been directed towards me, he charged over to me and regarded me through the loop. How could I forget seeing work of this quality? Look at it, he said, pushing the detached wing at me. It is a masterwork. Each feather is individually modeled and attached. The articulation is perfect. The attention to detail. I tried to look at the proffered wing, but the professor kept gesturing with it and manipulating the wing as he talked. Professor, Miss Bang came close to shouting, about our guest. Let him rest, let him rest. He's had a trying evening. I'm sure he must be exhausted. The professor continued to fiddle with the detached wing. He's right here, Professor. He whirled around in a circle. He is? Where?
Right there, Professor, she said, pointing at me once again. Oh? He looked at me through the loop. Oh! He opened his left eye and regarded me again. Oh, my boy, are you feeling better now? I know I promised to return you promptly to your uncle, but you were so tired I figured that it wouldn't hurt to let you get some rest. And I've had such amazing discoveries. It is a pity our only sample is so damaged. I would have loved to... Professor, will you pay attention? Miss Bang appeared to be on the verge of losing her temper. What is it now? He asked. Can't you see I'm working? Harmonious, do you know our guest's name? He looked from Miss Bang to myself and back to Miss Bang. What? Yes. Yes, of course I know what his name is. Don't be silly. Miss Bang carefully composed her expression before continuing. Harmonious, would you please introduce me to our guest? He looked at her, clearly confused, and I had to do my level best to keep from laughing. But you've met. He's been with us all evening. Her tone was utterly calm, and she spoke with the measured precision that indicated that the listener had better satisfy her, or he would be in an immense amount of trouble. Harmonious, would you be so kind as to tell me our guest's name? Why, certainly. His name is... And he stopped suddenly, unable in a moment's realization to speak the name that my great-grandfather had bestowed upon me. His eyes opened wide in the realization of what he had been about to do, and the loop tumbled from his face. I dove forward and was able to grab the loop before it hit the floor. I straightened and handed the loop back to the professor. I did try to explain to Miss Bang that my name wasn't exactly fit for polite society. I'm afraid she didn't quite believe me. Ah, well, I am afraid that a young friend is... I'm afraid that he is quite correct about the offensiveness of his given name. It would be... horribly improper for me to use such language. You're serious? He blinked at her. Of course I'm serious. Such a joke would be in very bad taste. I don't believe that anyone ever accused my great-grandfather of having good taste, I commented ruefully. He actually was quite a thoughtful fellow in his youth. I never did find out what made him so bitter and antisocial. I've often wondered... Wait... I was going to tell you something I just discovered. He looked down at the wing in his hand. Yes, that was it. You remember the birds, the clockwork birds? I nodded. Yes, Professor, it was just earlier this morning. Yes, they're a perfect recreation of the living creature, or at least as best as I can tell, given the amount of damage sustained. If I only had an intact specimen to examine. Miss Bang spoke up. You're drifting again, Harmonious.
No, this is important. Did you get a good look at the singers, the male and female leads?
At the opera? I wasn't quite sure where he was leading with this.
Yes, did you get a look at them?
Well, I'm afraid I wasn't really concentrating on them for most of the performance, and then when things livened up at the end, my attention was, well, elsewhere.
And you did? Other than that final song, they seemed quite capable, although somewhat uninspired performers.
She paused in thought for a moment. And I'm not sure how to describe that final performance.
Drat! I'd hoped that one of you had had a better look. Now we shall have to find what is left of them.
The professor moved back to his workbench and put down the wing and the loop.
You want to go after the bodies, Professor? Isn't that a task better left to the police?
He turned.
The remains, yes, but their bodies, I think not.
He lifted the wing again.
I think they were clockwork.
A clockwork man?
How is that possible?
I looked to Miss Bang, but she seemed fascinated by the idea.
But what kind of detail, Professor? And such a complex series of actions to perform upon the stage. And they were actually singing.
It wasn't a phonograph recording. Even with the latest equipment, one can tell the difference.
Yes! The professor looked like a child who'd been promised a new pony. Exactly! Such a perfect duplication of the living form. When I went down to the stage and examined the woman, she looked otherwise normal except for the side of her face. That had shifted down sharply, like a plate had been detached from some underlying support structure. I think that the same person who made the birds made the opera singers as well. But I need more evidence. We need to find what is left of those performers. So we're going back to the opera house? Miss Bang asked. Yes! No, we're already there. I'm sorry about the little detour, my boy, but I'm certain that your uncle is going to want to see whatever evidence we can find. And the police, Professor? Yes, we must be there before they do. The last thing we need is for them to tromp all over everything and destroy the evidence that we need. He grabbed a pair of goggles off the bench and headed towards the door. Come along! I had to hurry to catch up to Miss Bang as she swept out the room in the professor's wake.
Let's see. I've got another stopping point that's a little farther along. Do you want me to continue?
I'm enjoying listening.
I prepared several stopping points because I wasn't sure how long things were going to take. We followed the professor down two decks and back to the lounge I had first seen upon my arrival on the Argus. But instead of heading directly to the descending platform, the professor detoured to the windows in the lounge and looked down at the city. I moved over next to him and got my first sight of Prague from above. The city was laid out in repeating patterns below us. From the color of the materials and the style of the construction, one could easily trace the different cycles of construction in the city. The city glimmered like a jewel in the morning light. The day had advanced, and traffic could be seen moving about the streets. Horse-driven carts, steam-driven jitneys, and a few heavy trucks with diesel engines. Each was part of the life's blood of the city, keeping the flow of people and goods. Below us, that precious flow was disrupted. Streets and alleys were blocked by police lines. Bright linen banners strung out from lamppost to lamppost to discourage foot traffic, and barriers set up in the streets to carve out space for a collection of police vehicles. The fire brigade had apparently been and gone, for there was no longer any indication of further fires or even smoke. In the center of all this activity, where once the proud and stately opera house had stood, a shell remained of the few exterior walls that continued to stand. The roof had collapsed into the foundations of the building, leaving a broken scar on the face of the city. The professor surveyed the scene for a minute or two, muttering some comments about suitable locations that I didn't quite hear clearly. Finally he said, "Yes, that should do nicely." Turning from the window, he strode for the door against the far wall, calling over his shoulder, "Make yourselves comfortable. We're going to have to maneuver a bit before we can sit down." "We're going to land the ship, Professor." "Where?" "The ship? Oh, goodness me. That would be a huge waste of time, my boy." "No, just us." And he vanished through the door. Miss Bang directed me to one of the divans in a gesture and seated herself in a nearby armchair. Landing a ship of this size would involve the effort of the entire crew and a fair bit of coordination with local authorities. It is much simpler to hold the Argus stationary above a point and drop the landing platform. About the only time we truly land is when we are taking on heavy equipment or rather large amounts of supplies. Remembering the rather terrifying ascent, I inquired, "And this whole process is quite safe?" "Oh, certainly. Just keep a firm grip on the safety bars and you'll land right as rain. You did bring your goggles with you, yes?" No, actually. I didn't realize that they would be needed so soon. I'm afraid I left them in my room." I started to rise. "Shall I go and fetch them?" "Oh, we find they're so useful we usually keep them with us all times. But don't worry, there are always a few extra pairs of goggles in the observation booth." I became aware of the hum of engines in the background when they abruptly stopped, and I realized that it was the first time since I had come aboard that the hum had not been present. Kintobi appeared beside us as if by magic and bowed. "Sir, miss, I believe the professor is ready to depart now."
Yes, Kintobi, thank you. Could you be so good as to provide a pair of goggles for our guest? He seems to have forgotten his in his room.
Certainly, miss.
He snaked a hand into his jacket and withdrew a pair of goggles from inside and presented them to me.
I do hope these will serve you well, sir.
I thanked Kintobi as I accepted the lenses, and then we proceeded to the next room. The professor had his face pressed up against a tube that extended up from the floor. His hands were making minute adjustments to a series of levers mounted to the side of the tube. He pronounced his efforts to be perfect, and then looked up to Miss Bang and I. Ready to go. Hopefully this won't take long. I don't think we'll need to recover an intact specimen. A large enough piece to show the construction should be sufficient. He ushered us towards the door to the landing platform and its brass railings. Won't this be dangerous, Professor? I remembered the terror of our late-night escape from the wreckage below, and part of me could not believe that we were preparing to go back into the same environment. Well, there is some risk. Parts of the building may still be unstable, but most of the danger is past. The fire brigade will have the gas shut off, or they would never have gotten the fire under control. As long as the police don't bother us again, we should be in and out of there in no time. Miss Bang seemed perfectly at ease as she strode onto the platform, donned her goggles, and made sure that the hat that she had retrieved from a cupboard in the control room was well secured upon her head. The professor likewise pulled his lenses over his eyes and took his place next to the platform's central tower. Unsure of the wisdom of my actions, I let myself drift forward onto the platform, fitted the goggles over my eyes, and placed a hand on the center tower. I started to turn to the professor to ask another question, but at that point he nodded to Kintobi in the control room, who then threw a large switch. Lightning crackled through the apparatus above our heads, and I nearly fell over as I discovered that my feet were now rooted to the spot. I gripped the tower with both hands to steady myself, and it was at that point that the floor dropped out from under me.
Has this book been released?
No.
This is actually
part that I have not yet gotten to in doing the second draft. I've been going back and forth between this young adult novel that I started for NaNoWriMo last year and toying with a sci-fi novel that I had been planning for NaNoWriMo this year. And this weekend I finally came to the decision that I need to get Perils of Prague out there, so I'm stopping everything else, and I'm going to focus on doing the second draft of Perils and on recruiting beta readers, and then trying to get a finished draft done, both second and a finished draft done by the end of this summer, so I can start working on getting it published and starting to podcast it.
Oh.
Wonderful.
And my voice is tired.
Well, I mean, are we out of time now?
I think we are.
Technically, it's 11:55. We're 5 minutes over.
Yep.
But thank everyone for taking the time to come out and listen to us read.
Yes. It was fantastic, Joy.
I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed the story.
If anybody would like cards with 10% coupon for Bite Me that's coming out in a couple of weeks, please feel free to come up and get it. Mm-hmm. And thank you for coming.
It's like if you'd like to read some of the other stories that I've done, that you can. I only have short stories released. This is the first novel that I'm trying to get ready for release.
Oh, nice.
But I have two short stories that I did for the Every Photo Tells podcast that are now available in ebooks, and I have The Cross of Columba, which I did for Tales from the Archive, which is also available as an ebook. Go to Amazon or Smashwords or the iBook store and search for Doc Coleman, and you will find those.
Is your Tales from the Archive in Volume 1 or 2?
My Tales from the Archive is Volume 2, Episode 7. So if you want to go to the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences and pull up their podcast feed and listen to the audio of me doing that story, that's still available. The Cross of Columba has been nominated for a Parsec Award,
So I'm hoping I have a chance to make it to the finals this year. But
you have a lovely voice.
I was going to say, it's a pleasure to listen to you read.
I am trying to increase the breadth of my voice acting portfolio. So if you could use my voice, feel free to contact me.
dun, dun, dun.
Let's see, and swimmingcatstudios.com is my website where I blog about my writing and my voice acting and other things that we're doing. Swimming Cat Studio, Swimming Cat Studios is myself and my wife. She is my audio editor, and she is the editor behind everything in Cross of Columba except the music. We didn't have the right contacts for the music, so T. Morris did that.
Oh.
But we did everything else, and she is actually available for hire if you need audio production done.
Can I plug something for the ministry?
Go for it.
Incidentally, the Tales from the Archives 1 and 2 are part of rewards for the Kickstarter that is currently ongoing for the Ministry Initiative, which is a two-pronged endeavor to publish a new anthology as well as the Ministry RPG. I am the Ministry RPG writer for setting. J.R. Blackwell is the game designer. It's based on Fate Core system for those who are RPG players. The anthology has a lot of awesome authors in it. Delilah S. Dawson for one, Leanna Renee Heber for another, obviously T. Morris and Pip Ballantyne as well.
I am Jared a supporter, Axelrod. But I am not an author.
Well, your Tales from 1 and 2 are as part of are one of the rewards that you can get for an extremely good you're in the Big Steampunk Fiction Bundle. So you can get... hey.
I didn't know that. No.
So, in any case, because we're both in Volume 2.
Okay.
Yes, my story, A Swan in Siam, for the Tales from the Archives 2, is with yours in the Steampunk Bundle. So if you check out the Kickstarter project, and you can get the Tales from the Archive, both 1 and 2, at a very, very awesome value, along with some other stories that are steampunk-related. And there's also a blog hop going on right now, so there's a lot of giveaways going on for the authors and the bloggers that are on the site for the Kickstarter. So check it out. It's time to pimp yourself.
To pimp myself.
Yes.
Well, I have, of course... downstairs, I'm with Soylent Publications. I have a trolley, which is my steampunk horror that I produced last year. I'm also selling copies of the first book I wrote back in 93, The Saga of Punk Walrus. I found some original copies, and I'm selling them until they're gone. And I'm published in A Taste of Armageddon, which is a collection of short stories about war and the end of the world. Yes, I'm also on the on a podcast with Jada Adams there, the Fireside Meanderings, and occasionally we just meander for a while. I was running out of my basement for a while. You will see me if you go to see anime. I'll be all over KatsuCon. I'm the president of the corporation. And you can see me online. You can see a lot of my writings online. And I'm also a Redditor. So if you follow Punk Walrus, you'll find out a lot of the stuff that I write that's true.
Okay.
Let's see. I guess one other thing I want to add is if you enjoyed this reading, I believe I mentioned my short story, A Walk in the Park, that was part of Flying Island. I think it was here. I've done this so many times. I did a short story, A Walk in the Park, that was part of Flying Island Press's Steampunk Spectacular issue. That issue is still available. The short story I have in there is a story with Crackle and Bang and our narrator. It actually is a story that takes place later than Perils of Prague. But if you want to get more Crackle and Bang, that's one place you can get it right now.
Okay. Thank you all for stopping in.